The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So in this most recent times, it seems that in my meetings with people to talk about their practice and their lives, one of the common themes has been fear. And it's one of the primary emotions of human beings, and it's one that many people contend with. Many years ago, I asked a Dharma Seed, which is back then it was a company, now it's a website, that archives the talks for all the Vipassana teachers in the United States. And they have a big, big archive of talks. And back in the 90s, they would send cassettes before they had it on the web to people who would order the cassettes. And I asked them for the list of the top 10 themes that people asked for, and or the top not themes, but the top 10 talks that people asked for from different teachers. And four of those top 10 had to do with fear, representing, I think, how big an issue it is for many people. And I think that in addressing or looking at fear through the practice of mindfulness, it's important to remember that it's something to respect deeply. And just like with anger and other kind of emotions, that it's best not to take them as being unnecessary or unfortunate, but take them as something that deserves our respect. And what we're trying to do in mindfulness is to learn to bring a mindful attention, a special kind of awareness to them, an awareness which is healing, helpful, freeing, something. And in thinking about fear, it's maybe useful to think of fear as a messenger. And you don't want to kiss, you don't want to kill the messenger. I almost said kiss. So maybe that was good slip. Yeah, yes, we do want to kiss the fear. We want to get that close, get kind of intimate with it. But we don't want to kill the messenger, because it's not the messenger which is the issue, it's the message. And so fear is often an indication that there's something deeper in us that needs our attention, that deserves our attention, should get our attention. And that if we somehow, blame the fear, have a negative, aversive reaction to fear, that it can just make the whole thing more difficult. I remember many years ago, Joseph Goldstein teaching about fear, and he said something like, if a young child is afraid, you don't beat the child. So when you're afraid, you don't get angry at yourself or treat yourself negatively like you're a bad person for being afraid. That just kind of is counterproductive. But rather to offer respect to fear, care to fear, as something that deserves our attention. And there's many ways in which many kinds of fears that we will address as we sit in practice, because humans have many fears. I don't think it's necessarily the top 10 fears or top 5 fears, but in the teachings of the Buddha, he gives a list of 5 great fears, and which were maybe true back then. So the fear of loss of livelihood, the fear of loss of reputation, the fear of unusual states of mind, the fear of death, and the fear of public speaking. So, but there's many more fears. There's fears of pain, fear of violence, fear of being homeless, fear of insecurity, all kinds of fears of insecurity. There's fears of rejection. There's fears of heights, fears of spiders, fears of flying, fears of basically it seems that humans can be afraid of just about anything, given a chance. And, there's billions of people on this planet, there's probably someone who's afraid of something, almost everything. And And so to be able to turn towards fear and not be afraid of fear, I think is one of the functions of learning mindfulness practice. To have the inner stability, the strength, the wisdom, the understanding that supports us to turn towards the fear and not be afraid of it. And for some people, it's the fear of fear, which is their big challenge, and that keeps them recoiled from it or pulled away from it. And so one of the, you know, when you sit and meditate, for example, there can be developed over time a capacity to sit very calm, stable, kind of like sitting here like a mountain, solid and kind of a little bit in a good way, kind of immovable. And in that state, our relationship to fear can be very different than if we're agitated and feeling vulnerable and not stable and kind of, you know, feeling quite easily like we're about to collapse. And one of the functions of meditation is actually to provide that deep stability so that we have the inner capacity to open to our fear, to connect to our fear, to see it without being afraid of it, without getting agitated by it. So sometimes what's helpful with fear is not to address it directly, but to wait until we've created some degree of calm or stability within. And so meditate, or there might be other things you can do if you have an opportunity that can somehow change your state of mind, change your state of physical calm or stability, so that you put yourself in a position where you're better able to address or look at fear. One of the great places to look at fear is on a meditation retreat, where not only do we develop over time a personal stability and calm that's greater than what we'd have in normal, ordinary life, but the environment tends to be fairly stable and calm and often kind of more conducive towards meeting the messengers, meeting what's going on, and seeing it in a clearer way or more independent way, a freer way than we would if we get easily entangled with it. So there's a fairy tale that I think works well for this kind of mindfulness approach. There was a princess who was the monarchs of the realm arranged for her to marry a ugly, hideous monster. So this was a little bit disturbing for the princess. So she went to a wise woman and said, you know, what should I do? You know, I can't marry this hideous monster. And the wise woman said, you go ahead with the marriage, and when you go to your wedding bed, go do your wedding, do your marriage, but put on 10 wedding dresses. And when it's time to, you know, go to bed with the hideous monster, tell the monster that for every dress you take off, it has to take off one layer of skin. So they do this little thing where she takes off a gown and the monster takes off a layer of skin. And she's down and taking off the 10th one. Oh, the instructions from the wise woman was take off your 10 gowns, 10 dresses, and have the monster take off 10 layers of skin. When you've taken off your 10th dress, embrace the monster. That was things. So she's taken off her 10th dress, and the monster has taken off the 10th layer of skin, and the monster is just as hideous and ugly. And so, the wise woman said, then embrace the monster. So she went up and embraced and gave the monster a big hug, at which point the monster turned into a beautiful human being. And they lived happily ever after. So, you know, it's a fairy tale, and, you know, it's a little unfortunate that she didn't just accept the monster for what the monster was. you know, had to change into a human being. But still, this idea, and this fairy tale, that it has both these parts, the monster and the princess, is parts of ourselves, and that sometimes we're afraid of parts of ourselves, and that part of the kind of healing of that is to sit still and begin taking off the layers. And with fear, there can be many layers. It's said it's often the messenger. And so what is it a message of? What's the need that that's underneath it? What is it, what are the layers of emotions that go underneath? What are the layers of beliefs that come along underneath the fear that we have? There was a time in my life where I was afraid of people. And if someone asked me, I would say, just afraid. But when I finally turned around to look at it, I saw that the fear had to do with fear of rejection. I thought that they would tell me to go away and wouldn't have anything to do with me. And then if I looked underneath the fear of rejection, there was a fear that somehow I was inadequate. Somehow I was off or wrong. I was the kind of person that was unlovable or something. And then as I went below that, I saw that I felt quite tender and vulnerable without any interpretation of what that was. And then I kind of sat with that layer, that wedding dress, and then I took that off, and then I saw that I could sit there and be peaceful and just be there in a peaceful, open way, and that was enough. And that somehow that peaceful, open way was not so, didn't feel safe originally for me. And then it kind of fed into ideas that somehow I internalized or I'd learned or something, that somehow I'm wrong. And that fed into ideas that I would, because of that, I'd be rejected and therefore I should be afraid of people. And so, you know, as I went down through the layers, I came to a place where it actually was quite good. If I'd killed the messenger, I wouldn't have kind of followed those layers down and end up sitting in this peaceful place that turned out to be a nice refuge for me. And that was an example of kind of going, if you use the metaphor of down, like from the surface consciousness, going down into the consciousness, into the mind, to deeper and deeper layers. And many times people's journey is that way. And so we start at a surface kind of consciousness and we run into our surface emotions, issues, reactions, and anything. And so then we kind of have to deal with those and work through them, and it can take a while to figure out how to find our way. But there are times when it's possible, and this is one of the advantages of meditation, that sometimes we can, it's maybe an unfortunate word, because nowadays it's a pejorative word, I think. Or, you know, it's not acceptable anymore. But you can bypass it all. You know, it's called, you know, sometimes people call it spiritual bypass. It's valuable to sometimes to do that. And because you can kind of pass by all that, get to a much deeper, more open, calm place without having to work through all your complexes and issues and aversions and fears and all that. So you kind of like, you go down, you go deep, but you have to surface. And so then you address them as you surface. And but then you have a different perspective of them. Because if you come down to the kind of some base place where it's peaceful, calm, where you feel somehow have a friendly relationship to yourself, you feel somehow a place of security, well-being, openness, a place of goodness, variety of things that you can feel, kind of get down to the base of who you are. And then if you look up and see the fear that's up there, look up and see some of the difficult things that are up there, then you have a whole different perspective on it. Then there's a perspective, a certain perspective of a holistic perspective or a more friendly perspective or a more perspective that of ourselves where we're not so threatened by what we see. We're less likely to identify with it so strongly. So if we're going from the surface mind down, there might be so much ego, so much self-identity issues operating that we might think that I'm not supposed to be a afraid person. I've been meditating for a few years and I'm supposed to be a good Buddhist and be fearless. And so it gets much more complicated. But if we can kind of bypass all that to come down to a more peaceful place where there's no need for self-identity. We're not caught up in ideas of self and proving who we are, or all that. And then as we come from that perspective and come up and address the fear, then it gets much simpler. We're not complicating it with all these reactions and thoughts. And so then we kind of look at the fear and hold it in a more generous way, more open way, in a way where you don't feel afraid of it or aversive to it. And that's kind of what we're looking for in when we do Vipassana practice, is how to be present for fear without aversion, without fear of the fear, without complicating it with stories, with assigning a meaning to it. I'm afraid, therefore I'm this kind of person. I'm afraid, therefore I'll always be afraid. But rather to be able to hold the fear in a simple way. And one of the ways of saying this that I think is a little bit evocative and little bit like a Zen koan, like a little bit of an enigmatic statement that maybe you won't understand what exactly it means when I say it, but you'll remember it, I hope. And you'll kind of, what is that? How do I do this? You know, what does this mean? And it's a very different approach to fear than most people think about fear. I think most people want to get rid of their fear, solve the fear, quickly come to a place where they're no longer afraid. The approach of Vipassana practice, initially, kind of the pure practice, just being present for it, the task is to help the fear be safe. Your job is to help your fear feel safe. Your fear is afraid, right? That's the nature of it. What would it be like if you approached your fear with your attention, with your care, with your heart, and allowed it to be there, and you reassured it? It's okay right now. It's okay. I'm here with you. Now, this works best, of course, hopefully, in the place where you do your meditation practice. Hopefully, in the times and places where you meditate, there's no immediate danger. So that right then and there, maybe it's okay to hold the fear in a kind, loving way, or caring way, open way, help the fear feel safe. So then, once the fear feels safe, there's a few things that happens. One is that you can see it more clearly. Because as long as you have an agenda about the fear, as long as you have a judgment that fear has to go away, and you're trying to kind of fix it, you don't actually see it very clearly. And you're less likely to see a deeper layer. You're less likely to see how the fear is a messenger for something maybe more important. So to let the fear feel safe, hopefully lets you see it more clearly. The other thing that it does is that when the fear feels safe, then the fear can evolve or transform or move or heal in the way that it needs to do. Not necessarily what you think is supposed to happen. And it's hard to know, sometimes it's very hard to know what's supposed to happen with our inner life. And so to step back and kind of let the fear be safe and have room, breathing room, to be seen and be felt, then it begins to change and shift and move into something else. The other thing that happens when we help the fear be safe, just like be there, is a simple psychological, I don't know if it's simple, but a psychological technique that's used sometimes for fear, which is exposure therapy. You expose yourself to what you're afraid of, maybe initially in small dosages, your phobia, and slowly kind of learn to relax around it and not be so afraid. So we can do that also kind of directly by being with the fear itself. And sometimes being with the fear, offering the fear safety, and we're exposing ourselves to what's going on, and rather than recoiling or getting agitated or being by it, it's kind of like we're exposing ourselves to it. And one of the things we're doing is to be more comfortable with the fear. And in doing so, maybe we get less afraid next time the issue comes up. But as we become more comfortable with the fear, we learn how to hold it and be present for it without getting triggered in busy thoughts or agitated thoughts. And that's a great skill to learn, because it's You know, it does happen easily in life, in real life, that circumstances happen where we get afraid. There's all kinds of dangers in this world of ours. I don't want to belittle the dangers that exist in our world. There definitely are dangers. But if we're in a certain kind of way familiar with what fear feels like, if we've had spent time with our fear and gotten certain kind of comfort with being afraid, not being afraid of fear, then when real fear arises, we might be less likely to be confused or spin out or close down or contract in such a way that we freeze, or such a way that we feel the only options we have is fight or flight, kind of the gut instincts we have. And maybe we have an ability then to recognize that there it is, I'm afraid, and I know how to be with fear. Let me settle back, let's be a little bit quiet here if I can, let me get stable in my body and feel my body, and try to breathe and stay a little bit calm, and let me assess the situation more carefully, let me take a deeper look at the situation. What's really going on here? You know, what's the nature of this fear? And what's the wise way of responding to it? Maybe it needs a response of some kind. And so what would be the wise thing to say or do or do something? So the theory here is that if you get comfortable with being afraid, it isn't that you're comfortable with being afraid so you can just be afraid more often, but you'll be comfortable with fear so that the fear doesn't have the upper hand. The fear doesn't control you, but you have an ability to kind of be in charge, in a sense, while the fear is there. You don't give in to it. You don't, you know, go on automatic pilot around the fear, attack, or run away, or freeze up. So when fear arises in meditation, then it's useful to, dare I say, welcome it. To say, oh, this is my chance. This is not a mistake. It's not a problem that I'm afraid. You know, if you thought you were supposed to sit in some kind of blissful ninth jhana or something, and then, you know, the purpose was to have some deep, deep abiding sense of something, and you're a failed Buddhist because you're not in some, you know, wonderful concentrated state, then the fear is not going to be welcomed, and you're not going to take the time to learn the lessons for it. And it might be actually more useful in the course of a full life to sit with fear than it is to sit in bliss. And so I'm not saying go look for fear, don't, you know, make it up, right? Don't go sit, you know, in front of the lair of the mountain lion. If you sit and meditate, or if you have an occasion to be afraid and then sit down to meditate with it, if it arises and is there, you don't have to see it as an unwelcome visitor. Make it a welcome visitor so you can learn, so you can be present, so you can learn the skills, so you can kind of begin finding a new way of being with it. So you can discover how you are with fear. That might be the first task. Are you aversive to it? Are you angry that it's there? Are you afraid of fear? Do you assign meaning to it? Do you have stories you associate with it? Does it arise out of the stories you tell yourselves? Does it arise out of beliefs that you have about all kinds of things, of what you need and what you have to have and the nature of life? There's a whole, you know, it's a wide range of things to learn. Not that you have to do a lot of busy analysis and figuring out, but over time, if you have an occasion to meditate with fear and be present for it, you'll start learning these different dimensions of who you are. And it's very helpful to do it. It's very useful. And I think in some ways it makes mindfulness and meditation more realistic. It makes it help us address the real issues of our lives in a better way. And then over time we get wiser about it. Over time we learn to have this kind of unusual kind of comfort with fear so that we can not fall into the habitual reactions around it. So to help your fear feel safe. There's a story from Chinese Buddhism of a very good Chinese painter who was up against his canvas making a painting a dragon, a ferocious dragon, I think, or a tiger, I forget what it was. And so he was up, you know, close doing the details. And then at some point he stepped back 10 feet to look at the dragon tiger he had made. And it was so realistic, he got afraid and ran away. So how often are we the painter? How often are we kind of telling ourselves a story and spinning a tale in our minds? And that what frightens us is not a real life event, but rather the story we make up, the tale. And I think to some degree, anxiety is often a result of a story we're telling ourselves. That anxiety often is not much about an imminent danger, but a little bit an imagined danger, a danger in the future, something perceived. And if it's in the future, the role of the imagination is part of the picture. So if we sit down and start getting quiet and looking at what's going on, and we start looking at what's going on in my mind, what stories am I telling myself? What's the role of storytelling in the reactions and emotions that I have? It's quite remarkable, I think, to be able to sit in meditation and get a little bit of calm and settled. And so the body is a little bit more open and settled than usual. And then for whatever reason, the mind, in a moment, will think of something, a story, a future idea, or something. And then fear arises. And you can feel it in your belly. You feel your whole physiology changes. Your breathing changes, and there's butterflies in the stomach, and tension arises, contraction happens. And you are minding your own business. Nothing was happening but sitting here quietly, you know. And suddenly there's all these physiological reactions that arise because of the thoughts, the story your mind's telling you. This is a fascinating thing to discover and to see that relationship, because it's possible occasionally that in real life situations when you're with other people that the fear that you might feel in this situation is not there because of what the person's other people are doing, but your mind is making up stories about what's happening, interpreting what's going on. And as you learn to pay attention to this in meditation, how these subtle shifts in movement, maybe you can start seeing the role of the mind's painter, how your imagination and stories brings up fear, anxiety, that may be independent of actually what's happening in the moment. Fear is a messenger. And in Buddhism, there's a clear distinction between two kinds of fear. Between fears which are unhelpful, unskillful, that are suffering, and fears which are helpful. Fears which are beneficial. And the understanding in Buddhism is that a healthy, sound human being will have healthy fears. So it isn't that we're looking to be completely fear-free in Buddhism, but there are healthy kinds of fears. And the healthy fears have to do with the fear of causing harm in the world. A fear of doing unethical things, which is saying the same thing. And what I've seen is the more settled, more cleansed or clear or freer the heart becomes, the more we have a compass or more we have a guide or we have a reference point to notice when we're going to do something that we would regret, that we start doing something that would be unethical. Because to do something that's intentionally going to cause harm for other people, it actually causes us to lose and contract through a kind of violence to what's beautiful, what's clean, what's free within us. And so this fear, you know, if we come up against this ethical junction and feel this fear, oh no, I can't do that. I'm afraid of that. I'm afraid of even getting close to that. That in Buddhism is considered the healthy kind of fear to have. It protects you and it protects others. It's called the guardian of the world, that kind of fear. And it'd be good if more people had that fear, that kind of healthy fear of causing harm and just things, that which keeps us ethical a little bit. And then finally, if we can become someone, a person who does not cause harm in the world, not going to say things and do things which hurt other people, or at least not intentionally, then we can become a person who offers one of the great gifts to the world. And this is the gift of fearlessness. So not only do we help our own fear to feel safe from ourselves, but the idea that other people no longer have to fear us. And this is a wonderful thing, that people don't have to fear you. You might not think that you're a dangerous person. You can't imagine that people would be afraid of you. But when I was 20, I think I was afraid of everyone, regardless of whether they were really frightening or not. They breathed and walked on two legs, and that was enough for me. And I can tell you stories of how, you know, I froze at times. I remember going in freshman in college, so I guess I was 18, 19, and I took this English class, and one of the requirements of the mandatory English class was English composition. I guess we wrote essays and things, and was once during the semester you had to go and go to the office hours with the professor. And that was, you know, terrifying for me. And so I went in and sat down in a chair opposite the professor at his desk. And I promptly disappeared. And I was wondering why the professor kept looking at the wall right here, because the wall was right behind me. I was just like, and I don't have any memory. And so at some point, the next thing I knew, I was walking down the hallway. And I had no idea what happened, what had transpired. No idea if I said anything, we had any conversation at all, nothing. I had disassociated because of my fear. And then I'll tell you another story that maybe is, hopefully is encouraging for you. And, you know, in some ways, you know, in this Buddhist context, you know, and me being this ferocious teacher. First time I had a one-on-one private practice discussion, interview, with a Buddhist teacher, I was so afraid, with Mel Weitzman, my Zen teacher, that I couldn't speak. And so the first one-on-one instruction I got from my Zen teachers was, Gil, breathe deeply. So I've come a little bit since that time. I'm not really afraid of public speaking anymore. Maybe I should be a little bit more. Fear. I hope that this talk will encourage you to take a second look at your fear, and a third look, and a fourth look, to stop and pay attention to it. And I'd like to suggest there's a kind of a gold mine to be discovered. If you take time to get familiar with your fear, and you look at it, and make space for it, and don't dismiss it, don't override it, don't think that the right thing to do is just courageously burst through it and overcome it, and that's, you know, overcome it by just kind of overriding it. That certainly has its time and place. But if you really want to go kind of deeply and address your life, stop and take a look at it. And you'll discover all kinds of layers and depths. And some of you'll just discover that fear is a much more pervasive emotion in your life than you realized. And if that's the case, congratulate yourself, because if you have pervasive fear, apprehension that underlies your life, how you think, how you act, how you're in the world, it's much better to know it, that that's the case, than not know it. So if that's what you discover, congratulate yourself. And this is the beginning of a new life, a new way, or finding a way forward. There is hope, there is practice, there is freedom, there is a way to no longer have fear be debilitating or get in the way. And I'm confident all of you can do it, absolutely. But it takes time, and it takes one of the many things that can help, but doing this practice steadily, 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 meeting your life as it is over and over again, looking more deeply at what's going on, helping your inner life feel safe and so it comes out and shows itself to you, is a phenomenally powerful way of becoming free. So please, be afraid. We have about 5 minutes. If with a talk like this, maybe there's some burning question or concern or something you're afraid of that you want to bring up. And so we can take a couple of minutes for one or two.
Well, this is not something that I am afraid of, but I was sitting, we were giving a talk, another girl and myself, and she was actually giving the talk, and I was sitting there, and she said, letting go of all your attachments to self. And I felt this ripple of fear go through me, and I was delighted because I could actually see that. Because I know there's a lot of fears that I don't see, but that just came for me, and I think it's because of my being able to be with myself.
Nice. Great.
Thank you all for that.
Nice. And that's wonderful to hear a little testimonial. Thank you. Someone else? Testimonials are nice, little stories of...
I just had an image based on... You were talking about... embracing the fear from a deep place instead of looking down, being up. And the image that I had is if I'm above the water, it may look dark. But when I'm under the water, looking up with the sun shining, there's an illumination there that isn't from when I'm looking down.
Nice, very nice.
So I appreciate your
when
comments.
I spent a lot of time in the water, ocean, when I was a kid. And I love to go down 6 feet and look up. Mm-hmm. On the top, there'd be waves and agitation, but it was always peaceful down below. And I'd hold my breath as long as I could and look up and feel the peacefulness here and watch the...
Yes. Thank you.
Hello. We'll make this very fast. So I have a fear of bringing up a different...
Fear of what?
I have a fear of bringing up a different subject, uh-huh. Kind of, than a personal. So if anyone is in... If anyone is interested, I have some little half-page flyers here about what's happening in Yemen. We're going to be going to see our congresspeople. It's a great possibility the United States will stop funding that war. So I'm sorry to bring up a political thing, but it is happening.
Take one more question or comment.
I have a relative, my brother, who I think has a lot of fear and kind of issues and concerns he needs to work through. And I kind of think like, wow, it would be really helpful if he would have maybe practice, Buddhist practice. But that's easy for me to think and not necessarily easy for him to do or to influence. And I'm just kind of wondering if you have any advice, if there's, you know, in terms of loved ones who you think could benefit from this practice in terms of what may be a good way to support them or encourage them or something.
Yeah, probably the safest thing I could say is that hopefully you can make yourself a safe person for him so that even if he has a lot of fear that he doesn't feel like you're judging him or that you're trying to fix him or you're telling him somehow that this is wrong or bad or something like that, that he feels accepted for who he is. That's probably the best thing you could do. And then if there's openness to some suggestion, you could have a conversation and explore possibilities. You have to be a little bit careful. I'm glad you brought this up so I can say this, that if there's so many different kinds of fear and so many different dimensions of how it works for people, and especially if there's chronic fear, deep fear, there's issues of... it's connected to some very, very deep issues in human beings, both... sometimes they're not best addressed, some of these issues, with meditation, for example. People who go through major forms of trauma, it's hard in meditation sometimes to respond to it. And sometimes, occasionally it's counterindicated even, because any attention we bring to it can just make the trauma be reactivated and people panic and things like that. Or there might be physiological things, reasons for why there's fear. Nothing to do with nothing about meditation would particularly help, maybe, or even psychology, just maybe some medication. So it's such a broad range of things. So if someone has really a deep chronic issue around it, it's much harder to know how to support them, because of, we could easily say simplistic things, I'll just meditate or, do something. And sometimes professional help is needed to really address it. But I think that if you can make yourself safe, so the person, your relative, can just relax and feel a little bit around you and just be afraid and not have to worry about you.
Thank you.
Great. So thank you all very much, and hopefully this gives you something to look at.